I want you to do something for a second. Like wherever you are right now, whatever you're doing, I want you to just pause and feel your pulse.
Just take a second to find it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Maybe put two fingers on your wrist or, just place your hand flat over your chest.
Yeah.
And just feel that rhythm. Ba-bum, ba-bum.
It's always there.
Right, it is. And that heartbeat of yours, I mean, it has been going since before you were even born.
Which is wild to think about.
Totally wild. It speeds up when you're terrified.
Yeah.
It slows down when you're in a deep sleep. It adjusts to, physical exertion or if you get sick or even just when you're stressed out.
It's completely dynamic.
Yeah, dynamic. And by the time you reach the end of your life, that specific organ will have beaten approximately 3 billion times.
3 billion.
Yeah, 3 billion.
It is honestly a staggering number, especially when you consider the sheer mechanical reliability that requires.
Exactly. And the thing is, because we are all products of like standard high school biology and specifically what they call the neo-Darwinian synthesis, we just naturally assume there's a master blueprint dictating that rhythm.
We assume there's a boss.
Right, a boss. Like we know about the pacemaker cells and the sinoatrial node, and we know about electrical impulses and all that.
Sure.
But we assume that at the bottom of it all, buried somewhere deep in your DNA, there's a genetic code, like a localized string of biological software that explicitly says, beat at exactly this rhythm or sequence these exact actions.
Right, that's the standard model we all learn.
But if you're sitting there thinking, well, obviously my DNA governs my cardiac function,
Yeah.
This is where things get completely wild because there is no gene for the heartbeat rhythm.
None. Zero.
None at all.
It's one of those biological realities that just it forces a complete paradigm shift the absolute second you actually confront it. Because when we sequence the human genome, we find the genes that code for the proteins making up the heart's tissues. We find the genes that code for the ion channels.
Right, the physical parts.
Exactly, the parts. But as you just said, there is no localized line of genetic code that governs the rhythm itself. The rhythm is it's entirely emergent from the system as a whole.
It just emerges.
Right. And when you strip away that assumption that DNA is the master architect, you are left staring at a massive structural question.
Which is, if the rhythm doesn't come from a genetic blueprint, where on earth does it come from?
Who is actually in charge?
Right. If there's no genetic metronome, who is the conductor of that symphony? That impossible question is the foundation of our deep dive today. We're looking at a genuinely paradigm-shifting 2026 paper by C.F. Dietz.
It's a brilliant paper.
It really is. It's titled The Grammar of Life: How the Closure Framework Grounds Dennis Noble's Biological Relativity. And the mission of this deep dive today is to use Dietz's work to figure out if we are just like fleshy robots executing a predetermined molecular code, or if there is something fundamentally more agentic and purposeful about life itself.
And what C.F. Dietz manages to do in this paper is they provide the missing philosophical and mathematical bedrock for literally decades of empirical biology.
Because the data's been there for a while, right?
So absolutely, for a long time, systems biologists have had the data showing that organisms behave dynamically, that they constitute their own
They
reality.
aren't just vehicles.
Right, they aren't mere passive vehicles for genetic replication, but mainstream reductionist biology always demanded to know why.
Like, what's the mechanism?
Exactly, and Dietz provides the why. So today we are going to explore how life physically uses randomness, I mean sheer statistical noise, as a structural superpower.
Which sounds completely backwards, but we'll get there.
We will. We're also going to examine the mathematics of downward causation, and we're going to define biological agency not as some mystical vitalistic force, but as a rigid necessity of physics and mathematics.
Okay, so to really get into the mechanics of this, I want to start by unpacking that heartbeat anomaly, because Dietz leans really heavily on the work of the evolutionary biologist Dennis Noble.
Yes, Noble is central to
And I
this.
know Noble was doing computational modeling of the heart way back in 1960,
1960, yeah.
which is crazy because given the technology of 1960, I mean, we're talking about punch cards and room-sized mainframe computers. How did he even go about modeling cardiac rhythm without pointing to a genetic sequence?
Well, you really have to picture the historical context here. This was
Wow.
shortly after Watson and Crick proposed the double helix structure of DNA,
Okay.
and the central dogma of molecular biology was really solidifying at that time.
The dogma meaning DNA makes RNA makes protein.
Exactly. Information flows in one direction,
Yeah.
DNA to RNA to protein. Genes were basically becoming the uncontested dictators of biology. But Noble was interested in physiology. He was adapting the Hodgkin-Huxley equations, which they were originally designed to explain the electrical action potentials in the giant nerve axons of squids.
Oh, wow, squids.
Yeah, squids. Noble wanted to apply those nonlinear differential equations to the pacemaker cells of the heart.
So he was mapping the math of the electrical impulses.
Precisely. Noble was modeling the specific ion channels in the cell membrane. These are basically proteins that act as gated pores. They allow sodium, potassium, and calcium ions to flow in and out of the cell.
Okay, and the genes in your DNA do, in fact, code for the physical structure of those protein channels, right?
Yes, they do. That is their job. But the rhythm itself, the rhythm is a result of a highly complex, time-dependent feedback loop.
Okay, let's break down that loop, because the mechanics here are super crucial. How does the flow of ions create a beat without a master switch triggering it?
Well, it works through voltage gating. So when a certain concentration of sodium ions rushes into the cell, it literally changes the electrical voltage across the cellular membrane. We call that depolarization. And that specific change in voltage acts as a physical trigger that causes other channels, say the potassium channels, to suddenly open while causing the sodium channels to close.
Oh, I see. So the environment changes and that physically forces the doors to switch.
Exactly. So then the potassium rushes out, which drops the voltage back down. That's repolarization.
That's sure.
And then that new lower voltage triggers a different set of channels, including calcium, which alters the environment yet again and eventually causes the whole cycle to restart.
Wow. Okay. So the changed electrical potential is literally physically pushing and pulling on the protein structures of the channels. It alters their shape so they open or close.
Right.
And then the new ion flow changes the potential. Again, it's just this continuous dynamic loop.
Exactly, a continuous loop. And here's the really critical takeaway from Noble's work. You cannot isolate the rhythm in the sodium channel.
Right.
You cannot isolate it in the potassium channel. And you certainly cannot isolate it in the DNA that originally coded for those proteins.
Because it's in the interaction.
Yes. The rhythm only exists in the continuous mutual interaction of all the components. The heartbeat emerges at the level of the cell as a whole.
The whole cell.
Right. The cell isn't executing a genetic program. It is physically constituting a rhythm through the interactions of its parts.
Okay. I'm trying to visualize how this starts and maintains itself. Is it like a traffic jam?
A traffic jam.
Yeah, like you're stuck on a highway. Mm-hmm. And the traffic jam is a very real physical phenomenon that strictly controls how fast you can move.
Okay. Yeah.
And the jam emerges from all the cars interacting. But no single car has the traffic jam blueprint in its trunk.
I see what you mean.
The higher level phenomenon emerges from the lower level components.
Yeah.
But then it turns around and dictates the behavior of those exact same components.
Yeah.
You can't speed up because the jam tells you not to.
That is a really useful visual, but it actually misses a critical mechanical step when applied to biology.
Oh, it does.
How so?
Well, a traffic jam is a passive emergent phenomenon. It doesn't actively work to maintain its own existence.
Oh, right. People eventually drive away. Exactly. In fact, a traffic jam naturally dissipates as cars exit the highway. But a living cell actively manages its internal environment to keep that feedback loop running.
It fights the dissipation.
Exactly. The cell is expending massive amounts of energy, specifically ATP, to basically pump ions back against their natural concentration gradients just so the cycle can continue.
Oh, wow. So it's intentionally reloading the system.
Right. So while the traffic jam analogy captures the idea of a higher level phenomenon restricting lower level parts, it lacks the active purpose of maintenance that basically defines biological life.
Ah, okay. That makes sense. The cell isn't just a victim of the interaction. It's actively fueling the interaction so it doesn't fall apart.
Precisely.
And this dynamic where the higher level restricts and manages the lower level is what Dennis Noble calls biological relativity, right?
Yes, biological relativity. And it is a direct challenge to the central dogma of molecular biology.
The one-way street dogma.
Right. The central dogma assumes a privileged level of causation. It says that the molecular level, the DNA, is the ultimate source of truth.
And everything else is just downstream.
Exactly. Everything upward, like the cell, the tissue, the organism, they think it's all just a downstream consequence of that genetic code. But Noble's work, mathematically demonstrated by those cardiac equations, proves that there is no privileged level of causation.
So causation doesn't just flow upwards from the micro to the macro.
No, it doesn't.
It flows downwards from the macro to the micro just as strongly.
Correct. The genes build the ion channels, yes. That is upward causation.
Right.
But the cell as a whole, I mean, its electrical state, its metabolic state, its physical volume, That determines the exact environment in which those genes operate.
It sets the stage.
Right. The cell basically decides which genes to express, when to express them, and how to splice the RNA transcripts. The organ influences the tissues. Mm. The tissues influence the cells. The cells influence the genome. Causation is a two-way street at every single level of biological organization.
Man, I'm completely hung up on a metaphor, noble uses, which Dietz references in the paper. He argues that the genome is not a blueprint, but a set of organ pipes.
Yes, the organ pipes.
And it's such a stark contrast to what we're taught. Because a blueprint is entirely context independent.
Right.
Like if I hand a contractor a blueprint for a house, they build that exact same house, whether they're in a desert or the Arctic, assuming they have the materials. The instructions are completely rigid.
That's right. The blueprint dictates the form regardless of the environment. But if you look at the mechanics of gene expression, they are radically context sensitive.
Right, because an organ pipe doesn't play itself.
Exactly.
You can have a massive, beautiful pipe organ in a cathedral, but without a musician pressing the keys and pumping air through the bellows, it sits in total silence. It's just potential.
It's just potential, exactly. And the musician in this analogy is the cell itself, or really the organism as a whole.
Okay, how does that look physically, though? Like, how does the cell play the DNA?
Let's look at the actual mechanisms of epigenetics to see how this works. Wow. So the DNA strand is tightly spooled around proteins called histones. If a gene is tightly wound up, the cellular machinery literally cannot access it. The gene is silenced.
It's packed away in the toolbox.
Right. Now, depending on the environmental stress the organism is facing, say a lack of oxygen or the presence of a toxin, the cell will release specific enzymes that attach chemical tags to the DNA.
Like methyl groups, right?
Yes, like methyl groups to the DNA or acetyl groups to the histones.
So it's physically altering the shape of the DNA spooling to expose certain genes and hide others?
Exactly. The cell is reading its environment and actively remodeling its chromatin structure to change which genes are expressed. It is quite literally playing the organ pipes.
Wow.
The genome is a passive database. It is a toolkit. It is the cell that decides which tools to pull out of the box based on immediate physiological requirements.
If you're listening to this right now and thinking about all the times you've read headlines saying, you know, scientists discovered the gene for intelligence or the gene for depression, this framework completely shatters that reductionist view.
It shatters it entirely.
You aren't just a meat vehicle being blindly driven by your genes. Your cells, your organs, your entire physical and environmental context are actively participating in your unfolding biology.
It dismantles genetic determinism entirely, which is a huge relief, honestly.
Yeah.
But as empowering as that is, it actually creates a massive paradox for evolutionary biology.
Right. Because if the genome is just a tool and the cell is the one wielding the tool, how does the organism know how to adapt?
That is the big question.
Because, I mean, I am fairly well-versed in the modern synthesis of evolution, the idea that random genetic mutations occur and natural selection just weeds out the maladaptive ones over millions of years.
A blind watchmaker.
Exactly, as a blind passive process. But if the cell is actively playing the organ pipes, are we saying the cell has some sort of conscious intelligence? Because that sounds dangerously close to vitalism or intelligent design.
And that is precisely why mainstream biology has resisted Noble's interpretations for so long.
They hear active and think conscious.
Yes, they hear active adaptation and immediately assume it requires a conscious mind sitting inside the cell pulling levers. But Noble's third and fourth claims, which Dietz focuses heavily on in the paper, they resolve this without any need for magic or vitalism.
Okay, how do they do that?
Noble argues that organisms don't just suffer random mutations, they actively harness stochasticity, which is just a fancy word for statistical randomness.
Okay.
And because they harness it to maintain their own existence, biological agency is a real physical property.
Okay, we need to spend some time on this because harnessing randomness sounds like an absolute oxymoron.
It does on the surface.
Like if something is random, by definition, you can't control it. Under standard neo-Darwinian theory, a cosmic ray hits a DNA strand or a replication error occurs and you get a typo. It's entirely accidental.
Right.
How on earth does a physical cell harness a random typo?
Okay, let's look at a really well-documented biological mechanism. Stress-induced mutagenesis in bacteria, specifically E. coli.
Okay, coli.
When an E. coli colony is placed in an environment where it is starving, say it lacks the specific sugar it needs to survive, The standard theory suggests it just sits there and waits to die, hoping a completely random mutation somewhere in its genome happens to give it the ability to digest a new sugar.
But that would take forever, statistically speaking, right?
It would. The math rarely works out in the time frames required for survival.
They'd all just die.
Exactly. Instead, what we actually observe is that the starving bacterial cell initiates a highly coordinated stress response. It intentionally downregulates its highly accurate DNA repair mechanisms.
So what?
Yeah. And simultaneously, it upregulates the production of error-prone DNA polymerases.
Error-prone?
Yes. Enzymes that copy DNA but make a lot of mistakes while doing it.
Wait, it intentionally makes its own replication process sloppier.
Yes, it does. But it doesn't do it everywhere. That's the key. The cell physically loosens its chromatin structure, specifically in the regions of the genome that code for metabolic functions, while keeping its critical life support genes tightly protected.
Oh my God.
It is purposefully opening up specific sections of its DNA to the inherent thermal noise and quantum fluctuations of the molecular environment. It is increasing the mutation rate by orders of magnitude, specifically where a solution is most likely to be found.
Okay, so if I'm trying to picture this, is it like searching for a needle in a haystack, but instead of blindly wandering through the whole field, the cell sets fire to a specific patch of the hay, knowing that the fire, the randomness, will burn away everything except the metal needle?
I see where you're going with that, but let's tighten that up mechanically. Fire destroys, right? The cell is using randomness to create.
Okay.
A much better way to think of it is a hyper-accelerated evolutionary algorithm.
Hmm.
The lower level, the molecular level, is genuinely chaotic and random. The thermal collisions are blind chance.
Right.
But the cell as a whole acts as a constraining architecture. It dictates where that noise is allowed to impact the genome, and it immediately tests the resulting proteins against the environmental stress. The cell takes the blind chaos of physics and wrangles it into a highly efficient engine of search.
So it moves the dartboard closer, makes the bullseye bigger for specific genetic regions, and just relies on the random scatter of the darts to eventually hit a survival solution.
Exactly. Randomness isn't just an accident that happens to the organism. It is a biological resource that the organism deploys when its current genetic toolkit is insufficient.
That is just incredible. It's like controlled chaos. But this brings us to the most controversial word in the whole paper. Agency.
Yes.
Agent.
You said Noble claims this proves biological agency.
Mm.
And I have to push back here a little bit.
Go ahead.
Because if a complex algorithm in my computer runs a randomized search function to solve a math problem,
mm-hmm.
I don't say my laptop has agency.
Right.
I just say it's executing a really complex program. Why is the cell's feedback loop any different from a highly advanced thermostat or a machine learning algorithm?
This is exactly the debate that has dominated the philosophy of biology for decades.
I can imagine.
A thermostat is a designed mechanism that regulates temperature, yes. But a thermostat does not care if it exists or if it is destroyed. It has no internal drive to maintain its own physical coherence.
Because it was built by us. Its purpose is entirely external.
Correct. Its purpose is teleological, meaning it's imported from the outside by a human engineer. In evolutionary biology, the concept of purposive agency was effectively blacklisted after the modern synthesis hardened in the early 20th century.
They wanted to avoid religion.
Exactly. Biologists wanted to distance themselves from religion and vitalism. They wanted biology to be as rigidly mechanistic as Newtonian physics. But Noble and consequently Dietz bring agency back because the structural reality literally demands it.
So what is their definition of agency if it's not consciousness and it's not a programmed thermostat?
Agency is the fundamental property of a system actively maintaining its own boundary and coherence against the entropic decay of the universe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. When that starving bacterial cell hypermutates its genome, it isn't executing a fixed program. It is actively modifying its own internal rules to solve a novel problem it has literally never encountered before.
It's adapting in real time.
Yes. Its ultimate intrinsic goal is to not dissolve into its environment. That active maintenance of self, that orientation toward continued survival, generated from within the system, that is agency.
So it doesn't need a brain.
It doesn't require a brain at all. It requires a specific type of thermodynamic and structural organization.
Okay, I am tracking with you. Noble has 60 years of mathematical models of the heart of systems biology, proving that biological relativity happens, that genes are tools, and that cells harness randomness to maintain their own existence.
The empirical data is absolutely there.
It is super robust, yes.
Yeah.
But this creates a massive philosophical roadblock, which is the exact problem Dietz's paper was written to solve.
Yes.
Mainstream reductionists look at all of Noble's data, and they still just cross their arms and ask why.
Why isn't it just physics and chemistry?
Right. Why isn't life just physics and chemistry? Noble can prove that multi-level causation occurs. But he couldn't prove why any sufficiently organized physical system would inevitably develop downward causation.
He lacked the first principles.
Exactly.
Right, and Noble's arguments were always somewhat defensive because of that. He was constantly proving that his biological models didn't violate the laws of physics, but he couldn't derive his biological principles from a deeper, universal, structural truth.
He needed a foundation.
He needed a framework that explained why downward causation and agency aren't just weird biological quirks, but structural inevitabilities of the universe. And that is exactly what C.F. Dietz provides with the closure framework.
Let's dive really deep into this framework, because once I got past the dense vocabulary in this section of the paper, it completely changed how I view physical reality.
It is profound once you unpack it.
Dietz introduces two massive concepts that serve as the foundation of life: closure regimes and nested levels. Let's start with the first one. What mechanically is a closure regime?
In Dietz's framework, a closure regime is any system that stabilizes content and establishes criteria for its own identity across time.
Okay, stabilized content, what does that look like?
It is a physical or organizational boundary that draws a strict distinction between self and environment. Within that boundary, the system establishes lawful relationships among its elements. The closure regime literally decides what counts as a fact within its own scope, and it is operationally closed to everything else.
Okay, let me see if I can translate this. Is a closure regime like a highly exclusive VIP club?
A VIP club. Okay, let's hear it.
So the club sets its own internal rules. The bouncers decide what constitutes a cool outfit. The DJ dictates what music matters.
Right.
The club draws a very hard physical and social distinction between the party inside and the street outside.
Yeah.
And the club completely ignores the traffic driving by outside the doors, the weather, the taxis, the pedestrians. They don't exist as facts within the logic of the club. Is that close?
It's a really fun analogy, but again, the VIP club implies conscious bouncers making subjective decisions. In Dietz's structural framework, a closure regime is an objective physical reality.
Okay, physical.
Think of a living cell's lipid bilayer, a semi-permeable membrane. The membrane naturally filters out certain molecules while allowing others in, not because it thinks about it, but because its biochemical structure dictates those interactions.
Right, the chemistry does the filtering.
Exactly. The internal metabolic network of the cell determines which chemical gradients matter. It establishes a closed loop of cause and effect that sustains itself.
Okay, so it's a self-sustaining physical loop that separates an inside from an outside.
Yeah.
But what about the stuff outside?
Mm-hmm.
Like the stuff the cell can't control?
That brings us to the most crucial rule in Dietz's entire framework. Every finite closure generates remainder.
Remainder, like what's left over when you do long division?
Conceptually, yes, exactly. Because a closure regime is finite, it simply cannot model, control, or predict everything in the universe. It just doesn't have the computational or thermodynamic capacity.
It's too small.
Right. It can only constitute the facts relevant to its own internal organization. Everything else, all the unmodeled noise, the chaotic variables, the thermal fluctuations at its boundary, is left as remainder.
So going back to my club analogy for a second, the traffic outside is the remainder.
Exactly. The traffic is real, but it is unmodeled and uncontrolled by the club's internal logic. And Dietz emphasizes that remainder is not a flaw.
It's not a glitch.
No, it isn't a glitch in the system. It is a structural necessity of being a finite entity in a complex universe. The only system that wouldn't have remainder is an infinite system that models the entire universe perfectly.
Which doesn't exist.
Right. Since no such physical system exists, every living thing constantly generates remainder. A cell cannot track the exact position and momentum of every single water molecule bumping against its membrane, so that quantum and thermal noise becomes the cell's remainder.
That makes perfect sense. The cell has its organized internal logic, and it is surrounded by a sea of chaotic remainder that it just can't process. But life isn't just one single cell floating in a void.
No, it's highly structured.
Which brings us to Dietz's second concept, nested levels.
Right. A multicellular organism is not a single closure regime. It is a nested hierarchy of them interacting continuously.
Like Russian nesting dolls. Molecules form cells. Cells form tissues. Tissues form organs. Organs form you and me.
Yes, but with a critical mathematical caveat, each of those levels is a genuine closure regime in its own right, with its own specific identity, its own operational rules, and its own unique remainder.
Oh.
And this is where Dieth provides the actual mathematical proof for how downward causation works in physics.
I am so glad we're getting to the math of this, because downward causation always sounded a bit spooky to me, like the mind commanding the body in some weird dualistic way. How does a higher level physically boss around a lower level?
It comes down to a concept in differential equations known as boundary conditions.
Boundary conditions.
Let's go back to Noble's models of the heart. He used differential equations to map how the ion channels change over time. But if you just have the raw equations for a sodium channel, they are completely theoretical.
Just numbers on a page.
Exactly. To get a specific real-world solution out of those equations, you have to plug in parameters. You have to establish the physical limits of the environment the equation is operating within. Those are your boundary conditions.
Oh, okay. Like calculating the flow of water. I can have the fluid dynamics equations, but I can't tell you how fast a specific bathtub will drain unless I know the physical shape and volume of that specific bathtub.
Yes.
The tub is the boundary condition that constrains the math.
That is an excellent analogy. The bathtub physically constrains the fluid dynamics. In a nested hierarchy of living systems, the higher level closure regime serves as the boundary condition for the lower level closure regime.
Really?
The physical state of the whole organ, the higher level, constrains the tissues. The physical state of the cell, its total volume, its overall membrane tension, its macroscopic electrical voltage, acts as the boundary condition that dictates how the differential equations of the individual molecular ion channels will actually resolve.
Wow. So downward causation isn't magic, it is structural mathematics.
Yeah.
The larger physical container literally restricts the mathematical possibilities of the smaller components inside it.
Exactly. You cannot mathematically model a nested dynamical system without the higher level setting the boundary conditions for the lower level. It's structurally required.
Mm-hmm.
So when a cell changes its overall state, it alters the boundary conditions for its DNA, physically altering how the genetic equations play out.
This is the bridge. I
mean,
we have these two massive halves of a puzzle. On one side, Dennis Noble in the lab for 60 years, proving that biological relativity happens, that cells act as agents, that they harness randomness.
Right, the biology.
And on the other side, C.F. Dietz with the philosophical math, proving that any finite nested system will generate remainder and impose boundary conditions.
And when you synthesize them, the entire paradigm of biology shifts.
Yeah.
This is the climax of Dietz's paper, where they map the structural framework directly onto Noble's empirical claims, proving that life must act this way.
Let's walk through that map. Let's look at how Dietz proves Noble's first claim, biological relativity, the idea that there is no privileged level of causation.
Right. Dietz says this follows structurally because in a nested hierarchy, no single level can dictate everything. The lower levels, the molecules, generate the dynamics, the moving parts. But the higher levels, the cell, the organ, set the boundary conditions that constrain how those parts move.
Causation flows up via the components and down via the boundary conditions.
Exactly. Both are mathematically indispensable. You cannot reduce a heartbeat to its genes, because if you remove the cell, you remove the boundary conditions.
And without the bathtub.
Without the boundary conditions, the genetic equations have no specific solution. The whole system collapses.
Which perfectly explains Noble's second claim, right? The genome is a tool.
Hmm.
In Dietz's framework, the genome is just an element inside the closure regime of the cell.
Yes. The closure regime constitutes the facts. Therefore, the cell, acting on the boundary conditions imposed by its environment, decides which genetic tools are relevant at any given moment.
So the blueprint analogy is just completely wrong.
It is structurally invalid because a blueprint sits outside the system. The genome is deeply embedded within the nested closures.
Now, here is the part that completely blew my mind. Dietz's proof for Noble's third claim harnessing stochasticity. How does Dietz prove that a cell can purposefully use randomness?
Dietz makes a brilliant conceptual leap here. They reveal that Noble's concept of stochasticity, or randomness as a resource, is the exact same thing as Dietz's concept of remainder.
Oh, the chaotic traffic outside the club, the thermal noise that the cell couldn't model.
Yes. Remember, every finite closure generates remainder uncontrolled noise at its boundary. At the lower molecular level, that thermal noise is genuinely chaotic. But the higher level closure, the cell doesn't just passively suffer that noise.
Because it's a nested system.
Right. Because it is a nested system, the higher level can subsume the remainder of the lower level and use it as raw material for variation. When the cell is starving, it deploys the unmodeled remainder, the molecular chaos, as a search mechanism.
But like a jazz musician. I was thinking about this when I was reading the paper.
Well, how so?
Like if a novice musician plays a wrong note, it's just a mistake. Mm. It's noise. It's remainder. But a master jazz musician doesn't just ignore the wrong note. They instantly contextualize it.
Oh, I love that.
The overarching architecture of the musician's mind, their higher level closure, takes that lower level random noise and builds a completely new brilliant melody around it. The overarching goal of the song harnesses the lower level randomness and turns it into brilliance.
That is a highly accurate way to frame it. The wrong note is genuinely uncontrolled when it happens, but the higher level closure of the musician's structural knowledge integrates it as a generative resource, remainder deployed as resource.
It's beautiful.
It proves from a purely structural standpoint why organisms must use randomness to evolve. If they didn't, they would remain rigidly fixed and eventually shatter against the complexities of their environment.
Which leads us directly to the final claim agency. How does the math of a closure regime prove that biological purpose is a real physical property?
By defining what happens when a system fails to do these things, a closure regime must constantly manage its boundary conditions and wrangle its remainder to maintain its distinction from the environment. That continuous active maintenance is what agency is.
Because if a system stops managing its remainder, it reaches thermodynamic equilibrium.
Well, it dissolves.
It dies.
Exactly. The stark difference between actively maintaining your boundary and passively dissolving into the void is what purpose looks like from the inside of a closure regime.
It's not a ghost in the machine.
No, purpose isn't a soul imported from outside the physical universe. It is exactly what any nested hierarchy of finite closures structurally does. If it didn't exhibit this active maintenance, it wouldn't exist for us to observe it. Therefore, any complex living system we observe will inherently possess agency.
It is so elegant. It bridges physics, math, philosophy, and biology perfectly.
It really does tie it all together.
But, you know, as with any deep theoretical dive, it's easy to get lost in the abstraction. Let's bring this right down to ground.
Do it.
Why should you, listening to this, care about nested closure regimes and boundary conditions? How does this actually affect your health, your body, your understanding of medicine? Dietz touches on this heavily in section 6 of the paper. Let's talk about the illusion of genomic medicine.
For the last 20 or 30 years, the public has been sold a massive promise based entirely on reductionist biology.
The Human Genome Project.
Exactly. We were told that sequencing the genome would yield the cure for almost everything. The logic was simple diseases are caused by broken genes. Find the broken gene for heart disease or Alzheimer's or depression, edit it out with CRISPR, and cure the patient.
But if the blueprint analogy is structurally wrong, then that entire medical strategy is systematically flawed.
It is deeply flawed. When we actually look at genome-wide association studies, Dee says, we find that for complex traits and diseases, there isn't one gene.
Right.
There are thousands of genes, each contributing a microscopic fraction of a percent to the overall phenotype. You cannot just edit one out and fix the system.
It's like believing that if you memorize the entire English dictionary, you'll automatically know how to write a Grammy-winning song.
Ah, yes, exactly.
The words, the genes, are all there in the dictionary. But the dictionary doesn't write the song. The author, the complex nested organism, is what actually pulls the words together, heavily influenced by their environment, their history, their mood.
Yes. The cell integrates genomic data with everything else it knows about its environment. The boundary conditions are set by your organs, your body, your lifestyle, your stress levels.
Everything is connected.
If modern medicine ignores the higher level organismic closure regimes and focuses exclusively on the molecular level of the DNA, it will fail to heal complex diseases. You cannot fix the music by solely analyzing the atomic structure of the organ pipes while ignoring the musician playing them.
The paper introduces a concept called the grammar of healing, which it fundamentally changed how I view the mind-body connection. Dietz discusses the placebo and nocebo effects, which we usually just write off as psychological flukes.
We write them off because reductionist biology has no mechanism to explain them. But under the closure framework, they make perfect structural sense.
Okay.
When you believe you are receiving a healing treatment, a placebo, your highest level organismic closure regime changes its state. Your neurochemistry alters. That higher level state physically alters the boundary conditions for your lower level organs and tissue.
Downward causation.
Exactly. The altered boundary conditions literally constrain and change how your cellular closures wield their genomic tools. The belief mathematically triggers a cascade that alters protein synthesis, immune response, and inflammation.
That is insane.
The placebo effect isn't magic. It is the mathematics of downward causation, proving that your high-level closure constrains your molecular biology.
I really want you to think about what this means for your everyday life. This isn't self-help manifestation fluff. This is structural mathematical biology.
Real physical science.
Right. Your mental state, your physical environment, the social context of your life. These are higher level closures, and they are genuinely mathematically influencing how your genes are being expressed right at this very second.
In real time.
You are not a passive victim of a genetic code written at conception. Your biology is an active, purposive, ongoing conversation between every nested level of your being.
It is a radical reclamation of our own bodies. A medical paradigm that truly understands this grammar of life won't just try to rewrite a line of genetic code in isolation. It will attend to the cellular environment, the organism's context, the whole nested hierarchy.
Treating the whole person.
It requires treating the patient as a complex, purposive agent rather than a broken machine needing a replacement part.
Okay, let's take a deep breath and just synthesize this entire journey. We started with the mystery of your pulse. A heartbeat that no single gene could dictate or explain.
We saw how Dennis Noble's decades of computational modeling proved biological relativity, the reality that causation flows both upwards from the molecules and downwards from the organism.
We shattered the central dogma. We learned that your DNA is not a rigid blueprint, but a vast set of organ pipes waiting to be played by the cell.
We explored the mechanics of how cells actively wrangle the chaos of thermal and quantum randomness, using it as an accelerated engine of search to survive environmental stress.
And finally, we saw how C.F. Dietz's closure framework grounds all of this empirical data in unshakable structural reality. Life is a nested hierarchy of closure regimes. The higher levels mathematically set the boundary conditions for the lower levels.
The uncontrolled remainder is harnessed as a resource.
And biological agency, the drive to maintain coherence against the void, is the inevitable result of this structural organization.
It provides biology with the philosophical foundation it has been missing for over a century.
It is breathtaking. But before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final lingering thought, a question that builds on everything Dietz and Noble have proved, but stretches it to its ultimate logical extreme.
All right, let's hear it.
We know now that agency, downward causation, and purpose inevitably emerge whenever you have nested levels of closure regimes managing their remainder and setting boundary conditions.
Right.
Molecules form cells. Cells form tissues. Tissues form organs. Organs form you.
The nesting hierarchy.
Right. But is there any mathematical rule that says the nesting has to stop at the boundary of human skin?
Structurally, no. There is no physical law demanding the hierarchy ends with the individual organism.
So what happens when human societies, or our global ecological networks, or even the sprawling complexities of our artificial intelligence systems become sufficiently dense and integrated?
Oh, that's a fascinating thought.
Are we right now just the lower-level components, the molecules forming the boundary conditions of a brand-new, higher-level planetary closure regime? Are chaotic actions generating a remainder that some massive global entity is currently harnessing to survive and maintain its own coherence?
It's a profound implication. If the mathematics of the closure framework hold true universally, we might very well be participating in a higher level agency that we literally cannot perceive simply because we are trapped inside its boundary conditions.
In the grand nested cathedral of the universe, are we just the organ pipes for something else? Something to mull over while you're lying in bed tonight. Place your hand back on your chest. Feel that beat. Appreciate the magnificent, purposeful, mathematical grammar of your own life. You are an agent wrangling chaos, playing the music of your existence. Keep diving deep.